Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about laptops and beach-proofing your tech gear with Donna Tappellini. She's Senior Electronics Editor for Consumer Reports. Welcome back to the show, Donna.
Thanks.
So the August edition of Consumer Reports rates laptops, and the headline is Faster Laptops Make a Debut. And I'm wondering, what do we mean by faster here?
Well, here's what's going on. Intel has introduced a third generation of its Core i chips, Core i3, i5, i7, and they're faster to do particular things. So we've already pretty much gotten as fast as we can at word processing and spreadsheets and things like that. But something that a lot of people are doing more and more often is taking video, say, from their phones and wanting to watch it on their TVs or watch it on some, you know, something better than your phone. So one thing that they do is that you have to convert the video files to make them something that you can burn onto a CD or watch on your television. And so what Intel has done is they've built the chips to do the processors to do things like that more quickly. And we found that for tasks like that and for working on photos, these processors actually can be up to 20% faster.
So how is that going to feel to the average user, though?
Oh, you know, it's...
You know how impatient we get with our computers nowadays?
I do know.
Everything takes so long.
It'll still take maybe something that would have taken a half hour will take 20 minutes. I don't have specific numbers mm-hmm. in front of me, but I do know that when we tested it, it was 20% faster. So it really depends on what it is you're doing. If it's something that only takes a couple of minutes anyway, you probably will notice it less. If it's something that takes a while, you'll notice it more. It depends on the length of time that the task usually takes.
The MacBooks as well are the third generation Intel processors. How much of an improvement is this over the previous models?
It's the same processor, and it's about 20% faster for those tasks. For other things, you're not going to notice it. You're not going to suddenly, find that your spreadsheet does its calculations mm-hmm. any faster, because it probably does them as quickly as possible anyway. You probably don't even notice what's going on.
You had a tidbit in there about how to identify whether a MacBook is using a second or third generation processor.
The processor, Apple, for some reason, doesn't tell you the exact names of the processors on their computers, but all of their new computers now have the third generation Intel. For other laptops, for Windows laptops, there's a four-digit number after the name of the processor. So if it's the Core i5, you might see something like 3620. I'm making that number mm-hmm. up. But Core i5 3620, it's that 3 that you want to look for. If it's a 2, it's the second generation. And the second generation isn't too shabby either. And if you pick up one of those, you can probably save some money.
Was there much of a difference between the 15 to 16 inch and the 17 to 18 inch?
And as far as
how the processors operate,
no,
does it make any difference?
No, it's the same processors. What you have are the Core i3, the Core i5, and the Core i7. So those are the three different basic processors. And as you go higher up the chain, 3, 5, 7, the 7 is the highest end, and then the 5, and then the 3 is the lowest end. But again, all of these processors are pretty fast.
Very close.
Yeah. And, if you're somebody who's doing a lot of video processing and video editing, almost on maybe not a professional level, but just like on a level more than what the average person does, you might want to look at a Core i7 third generation. If you're someone who uploads your photographs and does some editing to take out the red eye and well, gaming is a different issue, but, just those kind of things like that, and then the basic computing like web surfing and emailing. Maybe a second generation is good enough for you, and they'll still be around for a while, and you can really save a few bucks by going for that.
You ranked the Dell 15R and an HP Pavilion as the two best buys for this round of laptops. They didn't rate at the top, but you called them the best buys. What gives them the biggest bang for their buck?
Well, let's see. Let's take the Dell 15R as an example. Mm-hmm. That is the second generation core processor, but it still had very good performance in our ratings, and it's $550. We had an HP Pavilion 15-inch. That was a third-generation processor, and that was $1,100. So, that had excellent performance, but it costs just about double. Another thing that's going on that people should know is as Intel rolled out these new core processors, the third generation, they've been rolling them out a bit at a time. So they introduced the higher-end ones first, and that's what you're seeing mostly in the market right now. So if you look at our August ratings, you might see that prices of a lot of computers are higher than what maybe you've been used to seeing, and that's because they're using the higher-end Intel processors. In the next month or two, that'll shake out a bit, and you'll see that you should see the prices starting to drop again as Intel introduces the less expensive third-generation core processors.
It made
it very confusing this time around.
Well, it's the rollout is it's a constant. I mean, it's a constant discussion on this show. Someone's constantly rolling out something new now.
Yeah,
I guess it's full employment for you. But let's also, I mentioned the HP Pavilion. That was in the 17 to 18 inch category. Another Best Buy for the same reasons.
Yeah,
price.
The top rated Samsung that we have, which is the third generation processor, was $1,400. Now this HP Pavilion, which is a second generation processor, is about half. It's $700. This one happened to have excellent performance in any case. It had over 9 hours of battery life, and it has a good size hard drive, 750 gigabyte hard drive, so you'll have plenty of room for things. The reason the Samsung is that expensive, on top of the fact that it's using the third generation processor, is it also has a lot of extra graphics video memory in it. So that extra video memory, along with the processor that it's using, makes it a killer computer for playing games.
Is that what affects its battery life, though?
About an hour less. It's about an hour less. Maybe there are various things that can affect battery life. But 8.75 hours for that Samsung, that's still a full day's work, or a full day's game. I don't know if you can play games for more than 8 hours. Maybe.
Well, I'm sure they're out there. There's an addiction issue.
I understand.
And then also the weight and that sort of thing. How big of a deal is that getting to be now? I saw obviously with the 15 to 16 inches, they're much lighter, but.
That was another trend I wanted to bring up. So a while back, Intel introduced this concept called the Ultrabook. Mm-hmm. And what that is it's a thinner and lighter computer, but for, you know, there have always been thin and light computers, but they've been expensive, especially 13-inch thin and light computers have been pretty expensive. So Intel came up with this concept that they called the Ultrabook, and they put out very specific specs for manufacturers for how thin they can be, how much they should weigh, how long the battery life should be, and asked them to try to keep the price around $1,000 or less. So there are a lot of these out on the market now. They're called you may or may not see the term Ultrabook in the name, and the other processor manufacturer AMD is also coming out with thin and light computers. So starting with our next batch of ratings, you're going to see a column thin and light, and that'll meet particular specifications for weight and thickness. So you should look for that if you want something that's pretty portable. The other interesting thing about Ultrabooks is that Intel specs also ask that manufacturers include a solid-state drive in the laptop. So what that does is it helps the laptop start up faster from a sleep state. Or even a hibernate state. So you don't have to sit there waiting forever for the laptop to start. The solid-state drive gets it moving faster.
Our definition of forever being, of course,
10 seconds. 10 seconds. That takes a long time.
Yeah, it cracks me up. now, turning to the beach, and portability. Consumer Reports did a comparison between the pricey vacuum seal bags and plain slider bags to protect our tech, our phones, and so forth. Tell us about the results. Which was better?
Yeah. Well, neither was better. I think they both worked about the same. But the great thing is, well, we tested five or six dry bags, if you will. They're bags that are specifically made to keep gear dry if you're out on a boat or even just sitting on the beach. And they ranged in price from $16 to $38. And part of the reason that for that price range is the size. So we tested some for phones, and we tested some that were big enough to fit an iPad. And we also tested hefty slider bags, which are the ones with the little blue thing that slides back and forth across the top. And those cost about a dime a bag. And we basically got the same results. So you can put your device into a hefty slider bag, or you can go out and buy one of these other bags and seal it up in there. But they both work. The way we tested it was we put books or something equivalent weight of a phone or an iPad or another tablet. We put that into these bags and we dunked it, and a brief dunking. We didn't let it float around for a long time. And then we also sprinkled sand, and we kind of half buried them in the sand, and no sand and no water got in. So that was pretty good news. And that applied to the expensive bags and to the hefty bags.
So why would anyone spend extra money on the more expensive bags? Are there any added benefits?
Well, you know, we didn't quite test this, but from my own experience, sometimes it's a little easier to read through them. But on the other hand, sometimes the sand scratched them up, the more expensive ones. So I've taken to using a hefty bag, and you know, if I can use it once or twice or three times, and if it gets too many sand scratches on it, I just throw it out and start with a new one. Some of the other advantages of the more expensive ones is some of them make it easier to seal it, to put kind of a vacuum seal on it. Mm-hmm. And what that does is that it's the tighter the plastic is against the device, the easier it is to read. So if you have something that has a really good tight vacuum seal, as was the case with the one called the dry case, that made a nice tight vacuum seal, and it was just a little bit easier to read because of that seal and because of the tightness. But you know, you have to do a little work to get the seal. It actually comes with a hand pump, and you attach the pump and you pump out all of the air.
And so you can hear through these things too.
Oh yeah, you can.
I was
hear
surprised.
Through them.
Yeah,
you can hear through them, and you can obviously you can press buttons and do finger swipes and page turns and everything with them. So yeah, so you pretty much get all the functionality once you put the device in the bag, except for photographs. You wouldn't want to take photos with that.
Well, you could, but
you could. I actually tried photos. I actually did try photos with a few of them, and they came out a little. Just maybe with a little haze around them. Mm-hmm. So if you're not fussy about the photo and it's just something really quick you want to capture, you might be able to.
Okay. Well, Donna Tappellini, thanks for sharing all that with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Donna Tappellini, she's Senior Electronics Editor for Consumer Reports. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Olympics and social media. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock for On Point. Severe drought is hammering crops in the Midwest and beyond. 1,000 counties in 26 states have been declared disaster areas. On Point checks in on the severe drought. That discussion at 1 here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
91 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, and a high of 96. The heat index could make it feel like 104. Clear skies tonight, a low of 75. Showers and thunderstorms likely on Wednesday, a high of 94 degrees. More rain Wednesday night, a low of 73. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, they've all come of age, and their ability to connect people in a satisfying way will be put to a new test next week when the 2012 Olympics kick off on July 27th. Joining us now to talk about that is Mashable reporter Sam Laird. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've written that social media will reshape the Olympics. That's a pretty tall order. How's it going to do that?
It's important to note that social media has existed for previous Olympics, especially Vancouver in 2010 and Beijing in 2008. But what's really different this time is the scale and ubiquity of social media, Twitter, and other platforms, and how central they've become for fans to share information and opinions, and for athletes to interact with fans and market themselves, and also for brands and other organizations to reach consumers. And the scale of that shift since 2010 and 08 is pretty amazing.
So what are there, like 900 million people using Facebook now?
Yeah, it's getting close to a billion. And in 08, it was 100 million. So it's a pretty huge difference, obviously. And in 2008, there was about 300,000 tweets being sent every day. And now that number is about 400 million. YouTube's growth has been massive in that time as well. And then other sites like Foursquare and Pinterest that are popular now didn't even exist in 2008.
You asked your readers how they'll use social media during the Olympics, and I was wondering what sort of responses you've been getting.
By and large, I think they will be using social media much the same as folks use it now for big sporting events like the Super Bowl or Champions League soccer, as sort of a second screen companion when they're watching on TV. I think a lot of fans have kind of come to depend on Twitter almost as a conversation that they're able to have with friends and strangers online while watching an event on TV. And it's a sort of complimentary experience that was never really a part of watching sports before at home.
Could this be good, though, for a lot of the events that don't get the televised coverage?
Yeah, I think so for sure. Another big aspect of this year's Olympics, in addition to sort of the social makeover, is the way that digital streaming technology is going to change things. I mean, NBC this year is going to be streaming every single event, every medal competition, every event in every sport. So if people are cable subscribers, they can download an app from NBC, and there's really no reason they can't watch even the most obscure events. And I think I read in Newsweek or something that in 1996 for Atlanta, NBC provided like 170 hours of coverage, video coverage of the Olympics, and now it's about 3,000. So
this year,
there's really no barrier.
Well, you know, news is going to break on social media, and we're used to that, like you mentioned earlier. But it'll break on social media networks before it airs on NBC, which has been the case in the past with the internet. But this year, it'll be much more prevalent, faster. Is there any concern that social media will ruin the televised broadcasts that have become iconic, the ones that they make their, you know, make the bucks on?
Yeah. The IOC does have some restrictions as far as what fans and athletes are able to share via social media from London. For example, there's no video allowed inside the Olympic venues, and I think that's largely aimed at protecting media partners.
Well, how do they control the phones, though? I mean, everyone's phone takes video.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the big experiment, and that's kind of what we'll have to see. I mean, it's easy to say you can't do this and you can't do that, but just how enforceable that is and what the punishment for, rule-breaking in that way will be remains to be seen. I mean, that's all been pretty vague. It's going to be fascinating to see how it all plays out and sort of this tension between everybody, being empowered to be a reporter in a sense and still big sports bodies and media bodies wanting to protect their brands and partnerships. And yeah, that'll be kind of the big experiment of this year's Olympics. We'll see how it all plays out.
Just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Sam Laird. He's a reporter for Mashable. We're talking about the Olympics and social media. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to Twitter. My address is Ann Fisher, WOSU. The International Olympic Committee is embracing social media this year. Are they doing enough, and what's in it for them?
Well, I think what's in it for them largely is that they have to. I mean, social media is a primary means of communication for lots and lots of people, fans, reporters, athletes, big brands. So it's kind of like they don't have a choice in a way. And they are doing some cool things for sure. I mean, they have this Olympic Athletes Hub where you can go and find verified Twitter and Facebook feeds of hundreds of athletes, past and present. But at the same time, there are restrictions, like I mentioned, on fans and athletes, and some athletes and former athletes that I've spoken to certainly do wish that things were a bit more open, and they can, and they were or would be able to, you know, post wherever they want, whenever they want, as opposed to not being able to post video, and everything must be done in the language or the rules, quote, in a first-person diary type format. So I think they're doing well, but I think there are people who would like to see a bit more experimentation and openness.
Well, what kind of restrictions are there for the athletes? Some of them have already gotten in a little bit of trouble, haven't they?
Yeah, a couple of Australian athletes, for example, got in trouble for they were in the States somewhere and posted photos of themselves posing with guns in a gun store. And they got in trouble, not with the IOC, but with their own governing body in Australia. Yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of the type of thing that, you know, an NFL athlete or an NBA athlete would get in trouble for doing here with their team. Yeah.
Right. So the biggest networks are Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Do you have any advice for people how they can get a better experience using the networks? Where to go, when to go, what to look for?
Well, the IOC has sort of a Facebook homepage kind of where they're sort of pushing out a lot of content there. So that's one way to get a lot of news and updates and behind the scenes kind of stuff from the IOC. And then I think, like I said earlier, that Twitter is really the big sort of conversation center for sports. So, I mean, I would say find good reporters, find good media outlets, use Twitter lists, find good athletes to follow, and just follow along as much as you want. I mean, just watching the games on TV on its own is still fun. So it's not like you have to jump on the social media bandwagon, but there is a lot that I think it can add to the experience for fans.
There's going to be cheering online. British Airways already has, for example, already has created a hashtag to cheer for their home team. What about Americans? I mean, what's the cheering online thing? How's that going to work?
The USOC is trying to rally support on Twitter, especially. They had last week a big sort of digital send-off for the American athletes, kind of the traditional sort of way that countries send their athletes off to the host country has been, you know, historically in a physical location, and that still happens. But the USOC tried to involve people online as well, and they're using the USOC hashtag a lot. Team USA is going to be a big one, just hashtag Team USA. And then kind of the cool thing about social media is I'm sure that fans and teams and athletes will come up with their own sort of rallying points and hashtags as the game go on. And we'll see how that plays out and how that grows. And that's kind of the fun of the sort of crowdsourced aspect of it.
And of course, it can cut both ways. Last week was the big brouhaha over the costumes or the clothes they're going to wear in the opening ceremonies. And that's
definitely.
You saw.
Yeah. I mean,
the critics.
Yeah.
Social media is great for
sure.
The critics.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen plenty of examples. I mean, outside of sports, especially where brands try to, start a social campaign that's going to be this big positive conversation about McDonald's or whatever. And, cynics or critics or whatever end up taking it over, and it becomes a forum to, bash that brand or whatever. And, I mean, athletes are certainly not foreign to the concept of getting really harsh abuse from fans via social media. So there is kind of that darker side to it, for sure.
And Olympic sponsors are getting involved. Visa has created an app that allows users to create custom cheers. What other stuff's out there?
Sponsors, the IOC, the national committees, everyone is trying to get on board here, basically. Everyone, if you're a big brand and you don't have a social media presence, you are blowing it. everyone is doing their own thing. Visa's a big one. NBC's obviously a big one. They've got a whole bunch of Olympics hashtags and channels, as well as the really robust streaming offerings that they have in their app. So, brands big and small are trying to jump on this for sure.
Are there any security concerns given the prevalence of the expansion of social media in the Olympics? I know they have lots of problems in London right now with security, but does the social media, does that add anything to it in a negative way?
I honestly think that physical security is not one of the biggest concerns of social media. I think the bigger sort of potential drawbacks are, like you said earlier, tension around who can share what from where and when, and the potential for brand campaigns to be hijacked, as well as athletes and other personalities to, take heat or abuse from fans on social media. I think sort of physical safety is pretty low on the list of potential drawbacks.
The Olympics committee is going to host live chats with athletes. It's created the Athletes Hub, as you mentioned earlier. What's that going to do exactly? How's that going to work? Is it going to be on YouTube or what?
I believe it'll be Google Plus Hangouts, partly, and a lot of Twitter chats. A bunch of athletes have done Twitter chats already with fans. Last week, several American athletes did it. Promoted by the USOC, promoted by Twitter, on Twitter as well. One of the cool things as well is that, any athlete with a decent-sized following on Twitter can basically decide at any time, hey, everyone, I'm going to, answer questions for the next 15 minutes, so fire away. Outside of, officially organized things by the IOC or other bodies, any athlete can sort of just hold court as much as they want on Twitter and engage fans there.
In a story by NPR, they talked about there was the British swimmer, Rebecca Addington, I guess her name, Adlington, two-time Olympic gold medalist, leading medal contender in London. I remember the story that she was getting a lot of abuse about her physical appearance on the social media sites, and she's blocked some of them. And she says she won't, but she won't stop using Twitter, which is brave of her. But she still says it, the comments do hurt. That's again, sure. Once again, that's part of the deal.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's unfortunate, but, there's a certain segment of the sports fan population, let's say, that is, comprised of huge jerks, basically. We see that in the stands at games. And social media is just another platform, another channel that, you know, the bad apples, I guess, can sort of do their thing, whatever it is. And, you know, Rebecca Edlington's one example for sure. Other athletes, I mean, soccer players in the UK have gotten really ugly racial abuse on Twitter. Athletes in the States have gotten death threats after, you know, big mistakes in important games. So, I mean, unfortunately, for all the cool stuff that Twitter and other platforms enable, there is that downside as well.
Well, what are you going to be doing? How are you going to be following the Olympics via social media, Sam Laird?
Like I said, I mean, I think Twitter will be my big go-to. Obviously, watching YouTube for those really classic moments that come out of the Olympics, as soon as they go on YouTube, be able to watch them again and again, which should be exciting. But I mean, I think Twitter has kind of become the place to go online for real-time sports conversation. Like news breaks there from reporters and even from athletes. Like I mentioned earlier, like, I mean, I think a lot of people have kind of taken Twitter for granted as being a sort of companion place while you watch the games on TV. I mean, sports are kind of like inherently social and they're inherently a shared experience. And they appeal largely to passionate and obsessive people. So social media's ability to connect and its nature of being always on, so to speak, are a perfect fit for sports. So I'll be there. And it's also great because if you're not watching the game, you check Twitter and you find something, there's like something going on that you have to tune into. There you go.
All right. Well, Sam Laird, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sam Laird is a reporter for Mashable. Coming up, we're going to talk to Russell Holley about a new raft of gadgets out there. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the conflict between the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. The church conducted a doctrinal assessment of the group because of its, quote, radical feminist views and positions not in agreement with the church's teaching on human sexuality. We'll talk with Sister Pat Farrell, the president of the nuns group. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Are you looking for an easy way to support our station? How about joining our Sustaining Giving program? As a sustainer, your membership never expires, and your membership renews annually and helps to focus more of your support on the news and information you depend on. Visit us at WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State Marion, presenting the Warren G. Harding Symposium, America at a Crossroads, the 1920 presidential campaign, July 20th and 21st. Tickets at 740-725-6340.
And join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher, a discussion of the latest fitness craze and the importance of the first 20 minutes of activity with author and columnist from the New York Times, Gretchen Reynolds. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon. Sunshine today, a high of 96. Clear skies tonight, a low of 75. Showers and thunderstorms for Wednesday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Talking about sound and games today on All Sides. Joining us now is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Thanks for having me back.
So there is an interesting new speaker out now called the HMDX Jam Bluetooth wireless speaker. That's a mouthful. Jam is not by accident. the word jam or what?
No, it's definitely not by accident, and it's not in reference to, you know, you jamming out to music either.
Right.
The container, when you pick one of these up off the shelf, they're actually in what looks like a jelly jar, a jam jar. And they actually come in a bunch of different colors, and they're labeled in the different flavors. So the one that I got is actually the blueberry jam, and as such, it is a blue lid, and the speaker itself is blue with black trim. And it's a very little speaker. It's just outside of the range that you'd be putting it in your pocket. But if you wanted to, you know, put it in a backpack or just have, you know, a speaker somewhere in the house that you wanted to connect your phone to or your tablet to in order to play music a little bit louder than, you know, what your phone or tablet are capable of, this thing actually does a pretty decent job.
Yeah. So how big is it? How big are they? The speakers or speaker?
So the speaker itself, it's a single speaker, yeah. And it pretty much fills, you know, the same size jelly jar that you would get, from your grocery store. So it's not very big. But what you know, as soon as you take the lid off, the only thing that's inside of this thing is the speaker, and it slides right out. And it just you can set it anywhere. It's set. You know, it's got a little rubber bottom so that you can put it, you know, just about anywhere and have it, you know, play music. You know, anywhere that you're, as long as you're in range with your phone, you know, playing Bluetooth. So if you were, you know, doing something around the house and you just wanted music where you were instead of, you know, your stereo system, then you would, you know, just bring this with you.
So how much time have you spent with one?
I spent about 3 days with it, where I carried it around and played music with it, you know, when I was in different rooms in the house. And it gets pretty loud. It's definitely good for a one-room speaker if you've got, you know, a smaller bedroom, or maybe if you're I used it once when I was cleaning the bathroom, you know, just something that's in a small room where you wanted to have music that isn't, you know, your stereo system, which is capable of filling your whole house with music.
You don't have it piped into the bathroom yet, huh?
Don't have it piped into the bathroom yet. I'm working on it.
So it works well, though. The sound's good.
The sound quality is, I mean, what you're basically looking at here is a $40 speaker. So the retail price for this thing is $39.99, and the audio quality is not, it's definitely not the best in the world. I've had Bluetooth speakers that are a lot more expensive that have also, you know, given me higher quality. But for a $40 speaker, this has, you know, really nice range to it. Mm-hmm. It'll get, you know, I listened to, you know, a pretty wide range of music, and I found that there were very few songs that didn't sound very good on it.
Are there other speakers similar to this on the market? Is there anything to compare it to?
If you walk down any of the, you know, the speaker aisles in, you know, a Best Buy or something like that, or, you know, Walmart, you'll find, you know, kind of less expensive, you know, right around this $30, $40 range Bluetooth speakers. But the thing that I found that was really impressive about this, you know, is the battery life on this thing got me about 60 hours of actual playback. So I had this thing off the charger for about 4 days, and just yesterday needed to put it back on the charger, and I was listening to music on and off, you know, that whole time.
Nothing lasts that long.
This thing, I mean, it's pretty much just a Bluetooth speaker and a big battery. I mean, it fits in that jelly jar. It's a little bigger than most things, but that's, you know, I'm almost positive that the majority of the weight of this thing is the big battery that's inside of it.
So, do you like it?
I'm a big fan of it. It's something that I'm definitely going to keep around. I think my kids are probably going to use it a little more than I do, you know, for taking around and listening to their music, just because mm-hmm. it's not often that I'm not, you know, at my computer listening to music or in my living room with my home theater system. But mm-hmm. for you know, just portable one-room audio, this is definitely a good little speaker.
And at the price point, it's affordable to let the kids take it.
Absolutely. I mean, for Bluetooth speakers, and that's the thing, Bluetooth speakers, you know, if you go too much lower than $40, they're either not very good battery life or they're really terrible audio quality. So this was a really nice cross point that I found, you know, for you know, you're not getting into the $100 Bluetooth speakers that are higher quality, but you definitely get the battery life of one of those.
And how many flavors are there?
The last time I checked, there were 6 different flavors, and they all have, I don't think some of them are actual jelly flavors, but they all had very, very jelly flavor sounding names. So when you see them, the display I saw when I was talking to the guys who make these, when I saw the display case, it really looks like you're walking into a grocery store and you're picking these off of a shelf of of different jelly flavors. It was the container is really, you know, a clever way of selling the speaker.
Yeah, because I'll actually remember it when I go in and check them out sometime. Well, let's move on to the Google Cloud Print. It's something that's actually been around for a while, but they're making changes and updating it since it was released. So first of all, what is the Google Cloud Print? What's it going to, and what's going on with it now?
Google Cloud Print was probably my favorite thing that Google has ever done, because I absolutely despise setting up new printers. They never work exactly the way that they're supposed to when you plug them in and set them up. It's something that every single time I set up a printer, there's something specific. Each printer manufacturer has its own set of rules, and none of them really follow any kind of line. And it's really obnoxious, even for somebody who's, you know, fairly technically savvy. So Google Cloud Print takes a lot of that out of the equation. If you've got a printer that's on your network or a printer that's plugged into a computer already, Cloud Print allows anything that has access to anything that you have shared with other devices the ability to print just over the cloud. So basically, my desktop is connected to my printer, and I have shared Google Cloud Print with my wife and my daughter, and they are in a website, there's something they want to print out, or they downloaded something they want to print out. They click the print button, and instead of going through printer drivers or, you know, having to deal with Windows or Mac, you know, whether or not it's compatible with either one of those, It sends it to me almost like email. It sends it to my Google account, and my Google account will just print it right off of the printer.
And you can do that to yourself as well.
Yes, you can set this up to work with anything, and you can share with a lot of people. It's really versatile because you can have it set up in an office setting with 50 people the same way that you would have it set up at home with two or three people. And you can set it across a bunch of devices, not just computers. You know, if I get something on my phone, somebody sends me an email on my phone and I'm reading it on a phone, someone has attached a PDF or something, I can actually print from my phone through Google Cloud Print to that printer and have it print out. And it's one of the big reasons I wanted to talk about it was the last 2 weeks you and I have talked about several of Google's other products coming to iOS devices, the iPhone and the iPad, specifically Google Docs and Google Drive. And both of those things work with Google Cloud Print. So if you're using those services, and or if you're using just the regular email service from Apple, you can actually print via Google Cloud Print if you have it set up at home and have it go, you know, pretty much anywhere you are, as long as you have an internet connection. So if you're out and about and you see something, you can print. And even if you're not at home, it will print on your printer at home.
What about the security issue?
It ties directly into your Google account. So as long as you're signed into your Google account, it works. When you're not signed into your Google account, it doesn't work. So you share it with people that, you know, also have Google accounts. They have to have, you know, either a Gmail address or a Google account in some way in order to have access to Cloud Print. But it only works with people that you've shared it with, and it only works with your login credentials. So it's definitely secure.
My smartphone is connected to my work email address, not my Gmail.
Just about every smartphone has the ability to set up, you know, multiple addresses for that kind of stuff.
Okay, all right. But, okay. So I'm Google Drive's on it now.
Right. Yeah, if Google Drive's on it, then it would work just fine with Cloud Print.
Okay.
And you can actually set up your home account at home, and then you can choose to share Google Cloud Print with your work address.
Okay, I get it. So you're all about that then.
It's so much easier it takes probably 10-15 minutes to set up, and I've set it up exactly one time. I've moved house twice since I first started using Google Cloud Print, and all I have to do is plug everything back in and it all just starts working again. I don't have to worry about installing new drivers or connecting it to the network or doing any of these things that for some reason you know, HP and Canon and these guys just haven't figured out how to make easier.
Yeah, it's like a miracle. I know exactly what you talk about. I know someone who's listening right now who's like, yep. Is this something that a lot of people use already, or is it still trying to get a foothold?
I think it's something that people that are aware of it use. Unfortunately, it's not something that Google really broadcasts a whole lot. It's kind of a feature that they've tacked on to a lot of other things, but it's not really a key feature that they really broadcast as something that's great as its own separate feature.
Why don't they?
That's a really good question. I actually don't have an answer for that.
Oh, I stumped Russell.
It's happened twice now. I feel as though I'm...
That was a listener before, though. I can't take credit for that. If you have a question or comment for Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or post your question or comment on Twitter at @AnnFisherWOSU or Facebook, whatever floats your boat. Okay, so shifting once again to Nintendo's new 3DS XL. They unleashed this a little while ago. People are starting to get some hands-on time with the device. What is it, and have you gotten to use it yet, Russell?
I've not gotten to use the XL yet, but I've actually used... This is actually the second time that Nintendo has done this. They had the original DS, and then the DSi, and then the DSi XL, where they basically took the same hardware and they put it in a casing with a much bigger screen, so that it would be easier to use for adults. And personally, I thought it was great because I don't have to worry about things like, you know, making sure it fits in my pocket or anything like that. The device pretty much sits on my desk until my daughter wants to play a game, and then I'll open it up to play with her. And this will be, you know, a lot of the same thing. The 3DS XL is exactly the same as Nintendo's existing 3DS console, which was, you know, the first of their game systems that has a 3D screen that doesn't require glasses. Mm-hmm. You can actually control how the 3D technology works in the device as you use it. And they've taken that and placed it in a bigger casing with a larger screen, a higher quality screen, so that, you know, and anybody who is interested in the game but not interested in the smaller screen size can really take advantage of the portable game system. And they've fixed a lot of things that weren't really all that great with the existing 3DS, like battery life was something that a lot of people complained about with the original 3DS.
What's it like now, the battery
life? They say that the battery life is anywhere from 4 hours to 7 hours, depending on how you're using it. And that's a lot better than the 2 hours that a lot of people were seeing from the original 3DS.
Now, let's talk about what is the size of it. I'm trying to visualize, again, what are we talking about now? How big is it? Is it something you carry around, or you're saying it's something you just leave on your desk?
Well, it's something that I would leave on my desk. It is definitely still pocket-sized. It's definitely, you know, larger than a phone. It's a lot closer to a 7-inch device when it's open.
Okay.
But when it's closed, it's you know, more like a 5 or 6-inch device. And it really is something that people will be able to put in backpacks or slide into back pockets, or if you have big front pockets, I guess you'd be able to do that. But
are you at all surprised that DS is hung in there and they keep developing it and that kids keep playing it and adults too? But
I think Nintendo is really the only company that's been able to be successful with, you know, the portable game system. And
yeah,
that's something that they've held on to for a really long time. The fact that the 3DS is, you know, continuing, I personally am not a big fan of the 3D screens. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of handing a child a 3D screen because of a lot of the medical research has come to show, you know, how long people stare at screens and the kind of damage 3D can do to children.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great with the 3DS because it's something that you can control and it's something you can turn off. So it's definitely something that they've put a lot of thought into. And the price point, you know, we look at a lot of these consoles like the PlayStation and the Xbox and the Nintendo Wii, and look at the price points for a lot of those things. The 3DS and the 3DS XL, you know, they're $199, you know, when you get them in the store. And a lot of these games, you can either get online or you can get, you know, the game cartridges, and those are still a lot less expensive than, you know, when you buy a new game for the PlayStation or the Xbox.
So when does it come out?
It's looking, the 3DS XL is going to be coming out in August, and it's going to, like they've done before, they've had a lot of different releases for Christmas. Well, they'll do the original release where people get really excited about it, and then they'll put together holiday bundles,
mm-hmm,
where it'll have a couple of games or some accessories or something, or a new color for when it comes out for the holidays. This is really kind of Nintendo repeating itself from the original DSi XL.
Right, whatever works. And are the games more expensive?
The 3DS games are more expensive than the original DSi games,
yeah.
But they're not going to become more expensive now that this console is out, because this is really just the same thing as the 3DS.
Can you just play the old games on the new 3Ds?
You can't. What they did was they set up the store in such a way that you could purchase older titles for digital download,
uh-huh.
But it doesn't actually have the cartridge doesn't fit into the older consoles. So you can take DS games and put them in there, but you can't take anything older than that.
Okay.
If you have Game Boy games or anything like that, those are not going to work.
Okay. Anything else that I haven't asked about this? We covered
that. I don't think so. It has, it's something that I implore anybody who's going to get one of these for their kids to just be aware that the 3D feature can be turned off and it can be adjusted. And anytime you have a 3D screen that someone's going to be staring at for 2, 3, 4 hours at a time, they really just need to take a break.
Okay. All right. Word of warning. Here's another question from Jim in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I got a question. I'm looking for some laptops for high school students. And I was wondering if maybe you can recommend something, a certain model, a certain brand, whatever.
There's so many different brands out there, and the interesting thing is that a lot of them are designed for different purposes. So, what kind of classes is your daughter going to be taking?
High school. I'm not sure. When it comes to technology, my VCR still flashes 12. So, but I've been school's getting ready to start. I got a 9th grader and a 10th grader. And they're both going to need some, laptops for school. They go to private school and stuff. They got Wi-Fi and everything there, free and everything. So
the easiest thing you can do is to make sure that the hardware that you get comes from a manufacturer that is comfortable with doing updates on a regular basis. And that being said, I think anything that you would get from either Asus or HP, if you're looking at a Windows machine, or Apple. Those are really the three that I'm most impressed with right now.
All right. Thank you.
Not a problem.
All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. And you can get any of those there's different price points for affordability purposes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Lots of variety. Well, Russell Holly, thanks for joining us today. As usual, really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me back.
And thanks to everybody for listening. I want to thank the All Sides staff. Associate producer Amy Jurovich. Welcome back, Amy. All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides volunteers, All Sides intern Rachel Ramey, and volunteer Andrew Sweet. Video production by Rich and Amber Karzmiski. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. Streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.